Hello and welcome to episode 18 of series 5 of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. Welcome again to the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you're a new listener, you will find over 100 episodes available at our website, which is thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. If you go to the website and you click on the podcast tab, you will see all of the podcast episodes going back all the way to 2020, which you can listen to, consume there. And that's where you'll get the best listening experience, regardless of which platform you're listening on now. On the website, we have links on our show notes. We have a full show note for each episode. And we also have links to our guests and any media that they reference in their interviews itself. Also on the website, you'll find links to our products and our services, our visual communication tools, our explainer videos, and our other internal communications products. So that's the best place to visit if you are new to the show or if you want to get the full podcast experience. Anyway, let's move into the topic for this episode's interview. I'm going to keep this introduction fairly brief. This interview doesn't need a great deal of introduction because it's so powerful and profound. Just suffice to say that if you are involved in any way, shape or form in championing, leading, initiating or managing a diversity, equity and inclusion program or a D&I program within your organization, please listen to this interview. Please listen to it fully. And hopefully there's something we can all learn about the way that we run programs like this, but also how we make sure that they have the impact that we need them to do in today's world. My guest today is Dr. Frank Douglas. After a 24-year career in the pharmaceutical industry, Dr. Frank Douglas is now a seasoned problem solver who assists employees, employers, and students in identifying exclusionary or discriminatory practices in their organizations. He helps them to determine their desired outcomes and find productive solutions to such practices by empowering them to reframe their problems, identify a better problem to solve, and achieve life-affirming success. So, hello, Frank. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Oh, it's lovely to speak to you, Frank. And just for our listeners who are all over the world, whereabouts are we? Where are you at the moment, just so we can position you geographically?
I am in New Jersey, actually central Jersey, and I'm about 60 miles from New York City.
Wow, yes.
From Manhattan.
Great. And I think anybody in the world will be able to position where that is. So regardless of their lack of knowledge of American geography, I think we can all position that. So thank you. Thank you again, Frank. So I think I probably did it a disservice there just by calling it a 24-year career. It's a fantastic career that you've had, Frank, and I'd love the listeners to hear a little bit more about your story about your time in pharmaceuticals, but also how this led you to what you're doing now, and I guess the topic of the interview that we're going to be looking at, which is systemic discrimination. But if we can maybe start more back with Frank as a young man starting his career, tell us a little bit about your background, Frank.
Oh, I'm delighted to do that. I'm actually originally from Guyana, which was British Guyana. And interestingly enough, I came to America in 1963 on a Fulbright scholarship as an undergraduate. But I arrived in New York about 8 days before Dr. Martin Luther King's famous march on Washington. And within those 8 days, I experienced what it was to be judged by the color of my skin and not the content of my character. So that was my introduction to racism in America. However, I, you know, had a an interesting time. I suffered both racism as well as help from fellow students and professors. So I saw both sides of things. And on the larger scheme of things, I witnessed in 1964 the Civil Rights Act, in 1965 the Voting Rights Act, and, experienced and was part of the tremendous change that occurred in America during those years that followed 1964. It is now amazing to me to watch all of that being rolled back. And people ask me, what's the difference, between 60 years ago when I came to America as a youngster and now? And I say, it sometimes feels like it's worse than it was in 1963. But I got my bachelor's in engineering from Lehigh University, then went on to do a PhD in physical chemistry at Cornell University. My bachelor's was from Lehigh University. And the single thing that actually shaped my career occurred when I joined Xerox as an assistant scientist. That led me to go to medical school. So I'm also a trained MD and did a fellowship. Did training at Cornell for the MD and at Johns Hopkins Hospital for my internship residency and fellowship at the National Institutes of Health, and began my career as a physician scientist at the University of Chicago's Pritzker Medical School. When about 2 years into it, I was discovered by the pharmaceutical industry. And I had the wonderful opportunity of the chairman of the Department of Medicine allowing me to take a year sabbatical and go to SIBA, which is now Novartis, with the deal that if I didn't like it, I could return to my position. And if I liked it, then I could continue a sort of an adjunct faculty member at the University of Chicago. So that started my career in the pharmaceutical industry in October 1984.
Wow, and fantastic. Thank you, Frank. And that's obviously, it takes us through that period now. So 84, yeah, I mean, I gave you 24 years at the beginning. I think I was doing you a disservice there. So tell us a little bit more about, because obviously incredibly well qualified. You're an MD, you're obviously you've been selected and encouraged to go and work in this huge organization, which obviously I'm assuming you found your feet there and you didn't decide to go back to the old job. So tell us a little bit more about that. Maybe then starting to kind of, obviously you had this introduction into the country when you first came across, and that wasn't a great experience from that respect. But then obviously moving into corporate life, this kind of discriminatory experience that you're having, it sounds like continued as well to a certain extent, and that's kind of led you to what you're doing now. Tell us a little bit more about that kind of your experience of corporate America, corporate life, from your experience, Frank.
Well, at SIBA there were two critical points. After I was there about 3 years, the opportunity occurred where I was the internal candidate to succeed my then boss, who was the senior vice president and head of research for the U.S. He had suddenly decided to change companies. I learned that although I was the internal candidate and as one of the members who was on the executive committee at the time came and explained to me that I was used as the gold standard when they evaluated external candidates, that I was not going to get the job. It was going to go to an external candidate. And he said he didn't know what more to tell me, but he thought I should know that, so I would not be surprised. I sat at my desk and recalled that about 6 months prior to that, I had participated in a program in Greensboro, and it was a fascinating program for leaders. And at the end of the week, the advice that was given me that in future, when I faced with being denied promotions, etc., because of my ethnicity, rather than just accepting it or changing jobs, I should challenge it. So I called up the CEO and I said, I've learned that you have decided on an external candidate, and I'd like to know, where do I sit in the mix? And he said, well, you're not number one and you're not number three.
Right.
So I said, well, could you explain to me why I'm not number one? And interestingly enough, he said, then come over, let's talk. So I went over and I had had an interview with him prior, which I thought was rather perfunctory. But then what followed was a real in-depth interview. And he looked at me and he said, why didn't you tell me these things that you're now telling me? And I said, what things? He said, well, for example, even now you did not tell me that you actually worked for two Nobel Prize laureates. And I learned that from one of the chemists, who know you very well. And I said, well, I just assumed that my past was not important. You would evaluate me based on my performance here. And I've been here 3 years. You've had enough time to evaluate whether I have the leadership qualities. I know I have the technical qualities and accomplishments to do the job, but do I have the leadership? Well, to cut a long story short, what actually then happened is I got the job. Okay. Now, 3 years thereafter, it occurred again. And this time, it was for the global head of research and development. I was at that time reporting to the global head of research and development, who was Swiss, was on the board in Switzerland. He called me to Basel to explain to me that he was retiring, and although I should be his successor, that would not happen because of my ethnicity. Max, he's unfortunately he has passed, but Max was, I could see he was really struggling. He was really concerned, very upset. And he was candid. He said, the reason, I have you here in my office is I can't tell you this if I were sitting in America. He said, but, you would be the first American on the, what is called the division leaders, the DL. Of course, you're black. And the KL, which is the board above that board, there are members who have difficulty with that. And also, you'll have to move to live in Basel, and your neighbors might have difficulty with it. So you won't get the job.
Mm. So I agree. I was just, how did you deal with that? I mean, that's just, I mean, I know it's in this day and age or any day and age. It's just.
Well, I to tell you the truth, I appreciated, and I told him that I appreciated his being very candid with me, and I told him I'd ask his assistant to immediately get me a flight back to the U.S., which they did. I went to see my U.S. Boss, the CEO in the U.S., and he confirmed that that was indeed the case that had been discussed, and he was aware of what was going on. So I then called a headhunter, and I said, look, I need a job as global head of research and development. That's my next move. I've just been denied it, and I explained what had happened. And I said, I need an American company. And so I actually got a job at Marion Merrill Dow, which was a mid-sized American company, as executive vice president in charge of research, development, and regulatory affairs. Now, fascinating thing that happened, about 2.5 years thereafter, Hertz, which was a large German conglomerate, bought Marion Merrill Dow. And then ultimately turned to Frank Douglas, to become the global head of what was became Herx Marion Roussel, because Herx bought 100% of Roussel Clough. At that time, they owned 57% of it. They bought it out 100%, bought it out outright. And they combined their pharmaceutical company with Roussel Clough and with Marion Merrill Dow to form Herx Marion Roussel, which became the third largest global pharmaceutical company.
Right.
And then became Aventis, and it's now Sanofi.
Yeah.
And I was tapped to become the global head of the merged company, Herx Marion Roussel, and the global head of research and development, be correct. And then when the second merger occurred to form Aventis, I continued as the global head of research and development for Aventis and on the board of management. So that was my life.
Wow. And I know, I mean, it's a really difficult question to ask, actually. Maybe I don't, but I mean, in terms of, you know, so I'm a great believer in things happen for a reason, and you always look back at things and you think, well, if that hadn't happened, then I would never have got the chance to do this. But in the circumstances that happened to you, I mean, how do you reconcile that? And you know, you ended up probably in a better place than had you got the first job, but the circumstances that you didn't get the first job were completely unacceptable. What's your kind of looking back at that, Frank, and with the kind of wisdom that you have now to be able to see that for what it was? And is the path you've trodden subsequent to that, nothing could be worth that sort of what you experienced, but how do you reconcile that in your own head?
Well, two things. First of all, every one of the episodes, and I just gave you the large episodes, every one of them is painful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the one thing that helped me, and I mentioned my time at the Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro, I was told, you know, challenge it. When it happens, challenge it. And look for an alternative approach.
Yeah.
Now, here is the thing that occurred. And if you would let me, I'll give you what, you know, we sometimes talk about, you know, my origin story, which explains why I do what I do now. After I got my PhD in physical chemistry, I was hired by Xerox. And for 3 months, I could not get a good project. And one day, a young white man joined the group. And within a week, he was put on what was the most exciting project in research and development that we had at Xerox at the time. I went to see my manager, had the usual discussion. And for some reason, I suddenly said to him, look, Steve, don't think of me as though I'm Frank. Think of me as though I'm Bob. And I'm still, as we're speaking about it, I'm reliving the situation of watching the awareness come across his face as he said to me, you know, you're right. Bob has been here a week and I've put him on the Ardrey project. Well, I was furious. I ran out of his office, dunked to the office of the senior vice president to give him yet another example of my being discriminated against. Now, 2 years later, I was now in a medical school. I began to think of that episode and realized that I had made two errors. The first error is that the senior vice president, Dr. Tribus, that summer had hired three young black PhDs to join the single black PhD that Xerox had at the time. And he had made it very clear he wanted to have more black PhDs in research and development at Xerox. So it probably was more important to him that Frank Douglas would do well than it was the Frank Douglas, because he had put himself on the line. The second thing that I had missed was what was my desired outcome. I did not want the senior vice president to go and have tough words with my boss. I wanted a good project.
Yeah, yeah.
So had I reframed and had I said to Dr. Tribus, Dr. Tribus, could you help my boss find me a good project?
Mm.
That would have happened yesterday. Mm. I probably would have retired from Xerox.
Mm.
You know, for heaven's sake, he was three levels above my boss. He would have walked into his office. He would have said, find a man a good project. It would have been done. Now, in the end of 2018, I was writing my memoirs. And when I was writing that episode in my memoirs, something occurred to me. And that was, I had actually learned from that incident, because thereafter, whenever faced with the problem of discrimination, I reframed. And that's why my mission today is to really bring this approach to as many individuals as possible facing discrimination, facing conflict, is to teach them how to reframe.
So let's explore that a little bit then, Frank, because it is at the heart of what you do now. And I think I've got some of the questions I'd like to ask you about it, but let's for now just let's talk about this reframing technique that you have then. So is it as simple as what you've just described there, which is really, you know, kind of very powerful, I can imagine, where you kind of redefine the outcome that you're looking for, which is not to be angry or get equal. It's to actually, and I'm not suggesting that's what your motivation was initially, but it's to kind of just, what am I fundamentally trying to get out of this? And let's pursue that rather than just feeling satisfaction that there's been some sort of superficial redress, maybe, you know. So how does that work, Frank? I'm really intrigued by this reframing approach that you use.
It is that and more.
Yeah.
One has to be clear on what's one desired outcome. But it's a process which helps the individual to do two things. First, to step back from the emotion just a bit. You know, in the 50s, 60s, there was a famous TV show called Dragnet.
Yes.
Professor Friday. He said, just the facts, ma'am.
Just the facts. Just the facts. Yeah.
And so we have what we call an intake form, in which we get people by just using simple sentences or bullets to describe a number of things. What's their desired outcome? What's the environment they're in? What's the situation they're having? Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. So to get them to step back. And then we do, from that, we help them do an analysis of the culture that they actually are in. Okay. Because the key to reframing is what I call finding a better problem to solve to get to your desired outcome. Now, what's a better problem to solve? A better problem to solve is a problem whose solution not only satisfies and or helps the aggrieved person to get to their desired outcome, but also benefits others in the work group.
Mm.
And that's the key part of it.
Yeah, I like that, and it reminds me a little bit. I mean, you may be familiar with Viktor Frankl, the whole thing around don't react, respond. It's you know, the ultimate choice with you lies within the way that you respond in a situation. Yes. No one can take that away from you, and I guess that's kind of at the heart of what you're talking about here, Frank.
Yes. And the response is, and people have asked me, well, why that? And I said, you know, I have observed two things. One, a person is aggrieved. And they have colleagues they're working with who are very sympathetic to them, etc. Finally, they get their issue addressed. And they're happy, and they return to the work group, and suddenly they find that some of their colleagues who were very sympathetic, etc., don't seem to be joyful and not celebrating with them. And they're puzzled. Well, the reason is usually very simple. Their colleagues also have had problems or are having problems, And it's okay that your problem has been resolved, but they're still having their problem.
Mm.
So, you know, you want them to celebrate your victory whilst they're still having their problems. Mm. So if you address a problem that also, okay, affects them, they are your allies to begin with.
Mm.
Okay. So you are looking at a problem that is larger than yourself. And as a matter of fact, it's a problem, the second part of it, that's a problem that your supervisor or manager with whom you're going to have the discussion about your problem can relate to. Mm. So here is the situation. You can go to your manager and say, you know, I'm being discriminated against. Well, you know, no matter how well that manager is trained or how empathetic that manager is, that is immediately for them somewhat an adversarial situation. Mm, they become a little bit defensive. You go to the manager and you say, you know, in the group, there's this problem that we have. You know, for example, there's some of us, we put our hands up and we're ignored. Mm. And, you know, we don't get to make our contributions, etc. Now, that is a productivity issue of his group or her group.
Mm.
They're now more in a position to listen.
Mm.
And then as the conversation goes on, you say, and as a matter of fact, I also have that problem.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole different discussion, and you're more likely to get a solution that helps the group, and guess what? Also solves your problem.
Yeah.
So finding a better problem to solve is a problem that benefits not only you, but others in the group. And it can clearly be seen as one which would improve the productivity of the group.
Yeah, I think that's a really good angle to come at it from, because then that, you know, regardless of what that manager or person's background is, the he or she, they will be, that is a motivation for them to solve a productivity issue, regardless of their own biases and prejudices, I guess. One thing I'm intrigued with, Frank, because your approach is very reasonable. You're taking a very reasonable and rational approach. I guess for me, you know, as a white middle-aged man, I'm thinking a lot of prejudice must come from a place of irrationality and also a kind of ignorance as well, not even realizing that is the case. How does your approach deal with people who, no matter how reasonable you are and, you know, how well positioned and structured your arguments and trying to find a better problem to solve together and getting as much ownership from them? I mean, what would your advice be in those sorts of situations? If you find yourself in that situation, you've used all of your techniques and you've been reasonable and you've been rational and you've been, you know, desensitized the situation and taken the emotion out of it. What have your experiences of that been, Frank?
Well, let me address it in a couple of ways.
Mm.
Actually, one, this matrix that we do, because one of the things we do is we evaluate the culture that the person happens to be experiencing.
Mm.
And we differentiate the aspirational culture. You know, that's what's written in the on the website and in the annual reports, versus the real culture that is happening, versus the culture that any individual is experiencing at the time.
Mm.
And we have a matrix which helps them to identify where they are in that matrix. So that's one thing that gives you a visual sense of where you are. The second thing is the following. In 63, and I go back to this, in 63, one thing that was actually very clear, there was a moral imperative to address many of the wrongs that were there. I mean, it's not only the vision of, you know, what happened on the march to Selma, you know, the brutality of the police, etc., that motivated at that time, President Lyndon Johnson, you know, to push through the Voting Rights Act. There was also a moral imperative.
Mm.
Well, if you look at what's going on in America right now, you have got, I mean, even evangelicals, you know, who say they are followers of Christ, and Christ says, you know, you should love your enemies as yourself, who are espousing white supremacy, you know. So the moral imperative is gone. People will do the things that benefit them. And if you are in a company, the one thing that is important to that company is its productivity and profitability. And in fact, Gallup, that did a 20-year study of over a million employees, I think 67 countries, I think the 90 different industries, found the following, that those companies that were in the top quartile with respect to employee engagement had, for example, 24% greater productivity and profitability than those who were in the bottom quartile with respect to employee engagement. And they actually now have a whole push around the relationship between employee motivation, well-being, and productivity. And so rather than dealing with, you know, the irrationality or the basis, the experiences that people have had, whether they're aware of it or not, that have led to their behaviors, let's just focus on the one thing that we all can agree that is a goal that we have in common. And the goal we have in common is that we're all being paid to be productive for the company. So let's focus on that goal.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, yeah, I'm hugely impressed with you that your ability to that objectivity, because I think it is. I think, you know, I often look at how this horrible kind of polarized, non-pluralistic world that we live in. And for me, I've worked in environments, you know, where it's been kind of more around labor relations, where, you know, it's like them and us, the managers don't trust the workers and the workers don't trust the managers. And whenever I've been in those sort of situations, I've always tried, you know, and not through any great education or moral fortitude, but always come at it from the approach that let's find the bits we can agree on first and make that circle as big as possible. Yeah. And then that by its nature will kind of squeeze out all the things that we can't find agreement on. And actually, if we can get a big enough island to stand on there together, maybe we can just get by, and all that other stuff we can just park and just, you know, we can be in a happy place for all of us. And I think coming at it from that angle is often a lot more successful than trying to, you know, kind of bring together right polarized ends of the spectrum and trying to find some common ground on them, because we never will. And, you know, you kind of look at what's going on in the world at the moment and it's just, yeah, it seems so far apart in some areas, doesn't it? It's almost impossible to see how it can ever connect. But I really like that approach of you know, finding the areas we can agree on and let's work on those together, and an incredible strength. So one of the things I want to talk about before we bring things to a conclusion, Frank, is that you know your approach. You know, I sense there's a strong personal, you know, it's kind of like personal effectiveness and how, you know, helping people who are facing that sort of discrimination to be able to deal with that and find that better problem to solve. What recommendations would you give to people maybe listening to the show who are in a big corporate environment where, you know, maybe they're doing things at scale, they're running a big HR programs, big kind of communications programs, big, you know, organizational development initiatives, and again I kind of think you made a nod to this earlier. You know, there's a lot of the what's overtly said about, you know, our kind of values and ethics and DEI and all of that. But then there's the reality of what really happens within the organization. What are your thoughts on, you know, kind of scale and particularly large organizations? If you could maybe go back to the HR department back in the day when, you know, you experienced some of the things you experienced and say, look, here's some of the things you need to do at scale to sort of address this. What are your thoughts on that, those kind of big corporate level programs and how effective they are?
Yeah, you know, I say that what we do is we work at the micro level to find the macro levers. These programs being done at scale, as important as they are, here are nonetheless some statistics. In large companies where there are these programs, less than 25% of Black employees say they feel valued. 49% of Black human resource professionals say they feel comfortable, or put it the other way, 49% say they do not feel comfortable discussing racial issues in their company. So, and one other comment. In my own experience, you know, just from the position, the positions I held with individuals coming to me to seek help, invariably you ask the question, well, have you talked with your supervisor? Have you talked with your manager? And invariably they say yes, but they're not listening. They're not hearing me. And so it led me to realize that the individual is extremely important. So we focus on the individual. And in large organizations, my recommendation is they focus on the individual. And after you have gotten a series of these situations, you begin to see the commonalities. Then you begin to tailor the programs for your situation as opposed to the general programs of sensitivity, etc. And that will begin to have more buy-in, because people, one, lose their cynicism because they see they're being heard. Managers see that they're dealing with real problems they're faced with. They're not worrying about, how do they apply this to the situation? They have a real problem that they have worked through, from which they have learned. One of the things which, you know, I'm really very happy to do for large organizations is to train their middle managers in this process, because there's something which we have. Part of the process is to have a panel. We call them our VIP panel, victors over injustice in their profession. And, this is a group of people who have succeeded. They have faced the discrimination and they have succeeded. You know, we take two or three of them to look at the case. So immediately, the individual knows that they're being heard, because these individuals have been through that. So in an organization, and some organizations actually do have, you know, special groups that are trying to get to this. But you in that organization, you take individuals like that at the middle level who are visible and whom people recognize, okay, can be empathetic because they have walked in their shoes. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, then the dialogue and the potential solutions happened at a different level. But this for us is key, is this focus on the individual and training groups of individuals who, you know, are recognized as understanding what's going on, who are legitimate. In the sense of those who are aggrieved,
you know,
and who are credible,
Yes.
You know, in the street we are saying that, you know, they have the creds.
Yeah.
They're credible. Is to have them be, you know, a VIP team that can look at those problems, and then you capture the learnings, and now you tailor the large programs you want to roll out based on those learnings.
I really like that. I mean, I think that has transferability into other realms as well. You know, that whole ethos and approach of having credible people who walk the talk, and they've been there, and having them kind of guide you in that area and very much focusing on the individual, I think is a really has transfer, as I say, transferable application outside of this sphere as well. So I think it's a really I think there's something in there definitely as well, in addition to what you've said as well, Frank. So really, really smart way of approaching it, I think. Just before we wrap up, I guess you're a very, very powerful conversation, Frank, thank you very much for that. I just really wanted to just really, if you've given us lots of wisdom and lots of profound learnings there. One thing you've not said so far, one final tip or thought for the listener who, you know, maybe someone who's facing discrimination themselves, or maybe in an organization where they're uneasy about, you know, some of the things you've talked about today and whether they're getting it right or not. I know it's difficult, Frank. You probably have hundreds of sort of pearls of wisdom that you could share with us, but maybe one final thought that we can close the interview on.
Well, the reality is that this is difficult. It's emotional. And one of the things that is not appreciated is the impact on the individual's well-being. You know, last year, Boston University released a study in the 48,000 Black women whom they had followed for over 20 years. And they discovered that those Black women who reported issues of racism at work, in dealing with the police or in dealing with housing, had 26% higher incidence of coronary artery disease and 38% higher incidence of strokes occurring at an earlier age. So this issue of well-being is not really understood, not recognized.
Yeah.
So it is important. So the tip I would leave, it is important to recognize the impact this is also having on your health and well-being. And, we are here. We would love for you to go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and look for our book, Until You Walk in My Shoes. And the subtitle is it's a reframing methodology to overcome systemic discrimination. You can do that. You can reach us on our website, which is safehavendialogues-llc.com. So reach out to us, and we'd be happy to, you know, to discuss approaches either on the individual level, and we focus on the individual, or at the organization level, how to start looking at the micro to get to the macro levers.
Excellent. No, and what I was going to say, Frank, is I'll put a link in the show notes to this. So there's on the website version of this, the people will be able to go to the show notes, and I'll put the links in there. I was going to put your LinkedIn profile. I'll put the link into your website, and also a link into your, the Amazon link into your book, if people want to buy a copy of your book, the more I've listened to you, the more I meant to buy a copy since we last spoke, but I'm definitely going to go onto Amazon as soon as we finished and get a copy and read through that, Frank. So, yes, thank you very much for that. Thank you so much, Frank. It's been fantastic speaking to you. I know we've been kind of,
trying to find a time in our diaries, and we had a couple of IT failures on both sides. So I'm so glad we've managed to have this conversation, Frank. And I guess you hear this, you know, from other people as well. It's a very powerful and profound story, and I really appreciate your candor and your openness, and which I guess is fundamental to what you do, of sharing that with us. So we can walk in your shoes to a very small extent anyway, and kind of understand that career journey that you've been on, but also how that's led to the really powerful work that you're doing now. So just thank you so much for sharing that with our listeners, Frank.
Well, you're welcome, and it has been my privilege, and it's my mission.
Absolutely. Well, look, thank you, Frank. I'll let you get back to thinking about playing your grandson at chess, which I know is your other passion and your love of chess, and wish you all the best, and hopefully we'll catch up at some point in the future, Frank. Thank you so much.
Look forward to it. Thank you indeed for the invite.
Thank you, Frank. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you've got any ideas for episodes you'd like us to cover in future, you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can use the feedback form at engagingic.com. If you're not already subscribed to the show via your podcast platform, please do so. And if you could leave a review for us, that would be absolutely fantastic. We have links to other episodes at engagingic.com. All of our previous episodes are available there. And if you're interested in our visual communication services, our big pictures, our learning maps, our explainer videos, and also our live graphic recording, please get in touch with us again at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. Thank you.